Hello there, everybody. My name is Sophie Aldred, and I had the enormously great pleasure of playing the character of Ace in Doctor Who. And I would like to just remind you that you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. It's not private, it's public. And it means that you, the public, can listen to this Gallifrey Public Radio. And I'm very honoured to be on it and interviewed by it. So I hope you really enjoy the interview with me and all the other amazing stuff that they put out. And thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting Doctor Who all these years and for all this time. Because without you, Doctor Who wouldn't be the show it is today.
I'm Amos, host of Undaunted, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whitaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Keir Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 269 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've just returned from the absolute weirdest evening at medieval times you could possibly imagine. Seriously, we couldn't even finish our turkey legs and giant 48-ounce soda, we were so confused. There was this evil baked potato in aluminum foil, you see, and a bunch of mute scientists wearing Beats by Dre headphones. Maybe you just had to be there. I'm Jay.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Keir. This week, we embark on what is probably one of our absolute favorite eras in classic Doctor Who, and is defined not by the iteration of the Doctor itself, but actually by the companion. I mean, well, our companion, our Sarah Jane. With the start of Season 11, the Third Doctor finds himself working alone at the start of the Time Warrior, only to cross paths with someone as resourceful, as adaptable, as quick-thinking, and as boundlessly curious as he is. One well-timed, sort of ill-fated, innocent step into a moving TARDIS, and we are off to see what Rupert Holmes does with the premise of what's essentially a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, you know, if you think about it.
Yeah. Well, and joining us for the conversation this week is one of the well-recognized voices of the Exceptional Verity podcast staff. Welcome at long last to GPR, Deb Stanish.
Well, thank you so much. And it is at long last. Thanks to some major technical difficulties here, like, you know, podcasting, I'm so new to it. But thank you all very much for your patience. And I'm thrilled to be here.
It is the wave of the future. This podcasting thing, it is going to take off.
No, really? Never going to catch on.
You think? I don't know. It's kind of new. I might have to like update. Like I have this like Zoom thing. I wonder if I can do that. I don't know. Do they podcast on Zooms?
I think, well, they might. You might have to slow them down quite a bit.
Well, you can burn your podcasts onto a CD like I used to do in college.
CDs? What are those?
It's like mixtapes, but only really thin. All right. Well, we always like to start these off, all of our classic rewatches, with just getting the right off the cuff takes. You know, just whether you've seen it once or you've seen it 100 times, just on your most recent iteration, just your step back impressions of it. And we'd like to start with Haley because more often than not, this is her first opportunity to see these stories. Haley, I don't remember. Have we taken you through the Time Warrior before?
Nope.
Okay, well, here we go. So, first blush, how do we feel about it?
I really, really liked it. I would like to watch it again.
Well, we're jumping already to the end of the conversation, yeah. But that's
well, when I finished it, I was like, oh, if I didn't have to go record a stupid podcast, I would watch this again right now.
All right. Oh, well, like, high praise indeed. Jay, I know where you're going to head with this because I know we were texting back and forth in this, and you had this is a conversation that you and I have often, but it really has to do with something that that Drew Meyer brought up with us in a conversation about a month and a half or so back that had to do with treating a serial story like a true serial story. You want to kind of take me through this?
So, I mean, one of the things when you're getting through serial stories like this, you can find yourself at the last minute scrambling, being like, oh, crap, I need to watch the episode. Oh, there's six parts to it. Shoot. So, kind of a timing thing. You watch an episode a day or something leading up to it, and it gives you that little break to digest it and things like that. And it's you can get a lot more out of it. Well, I attempted to do that with this story, and I started episode one, and next thing I knew, it was 2 hours later, and I'm like, wait, I want to watch this again now.
Mm, yeah. So Deb, I don't know. I'm gonna just toss it out to you and say, how many times have you found yourself going over this particular story? Just a milestone aspects of it aside, just the nature of the story itself.
Actually, this is only the second time I've watched it in preparation for this podcast. It's true. It's true. And, I have to say, it's one of those stories that I appreciate a lot for what it does, but it's not one of my favorites. And I think that's just a very personal thing. It's not for me sort of thing. And I can get more into that later as we talk about this episode.
Oh,
but there's things about this I adore and love, and things that I find extremely confounding. But this was my second time, and I'm glad I had an opportunity to watch it again.
All right. Well, we've got the basic story right on the premise where we're dealing with, obviously, Lynx the Centauran. First instance where we're seeing them, but obviously the Doctor makes allusions to the fact that he's dealt with this particular this species before. I thought it was... As far as on the surface, the work that went into the writing for this, as far as what Robert Holmes was doing, as we've seen with so many of his stories, he likes to put some plausibility into the scientific aspects of what he's experimenting with. So we have things like, Lynx doesn't speak until when he first meets, these Terran creatures of whatever period they happen to be from. And he has to fuss around with his gadgetry in order to communicate with them. So he's, this is something I noticed. I was taking Julie through her first watching of this, and she said, well, wait, the TARDIS isn't there yet. How come he's speaking English? And I said, thing in the hip. He's got some just translation device. Okay, she moves forward with that, and through all of these things, they make this discussion of the Centaurans being a species from a planet with whatever how many times the gravitational impact and so forth. So, but he's not. Because of the nature of his build, he's not built for leverage and all these kinds of conversations. So we're dealing with things like all of these aspects of physics and these things that made it enjoyable on a number of levels. But I'll ask though, aside from just dealing with the Centauran threat, there's a whole other series of things that are getting touched upon here. The Doctor functioning essentially, at least at the outset, without a companion. We're dealing with what is, I remember having a conversation with Don Cleese, who we've just had on recently, who was talking about this being sort of a prototypical Whovian episode for a number of them to follow, as far as the idea of going back and doing a trip into the past where you have to make sure you leave no footprint. Mm-hmm. And this becomes almost like the template for a number of episodes that we deal with and continue to in Modern Who as well. So as far as just the nature of the story construct itself and those things, how do we feel about this idea of I'm going to continue to call it the Connecticut Yankee because that's really what we're dealing with here. Science as magic. I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. As you were describing it, the thing that I kept on thinking was this. That's the same kind of thing that we got from the Aztecs with the first Doctor.
Yeah.
Where it was, go back, study the history, but no, you can't save anyone's life. You can't stop anything that was already going to happen kind of thing. Whereas this is kind of the opposite side of the coin where it's like, okay, things are happening that we have to stop because they weren't supposed to. So it's kind of the inverse that we got, but I really do like this better because it's, you're able to take a much more active role. The doctor gets involved. It's not just, let's sit back and watch what happens because we can't change anything.
I don't really know where I'd want to begin to sort of take apart any sort of historical accuracy or anything of that sort. I don't really want to hyper analyze those references. I mean, other than the fact that I really love the fact that Sarah Jane was convinced that she was stuck in some sort of a historical reenactment village for the longest time, because I've been in them, and it's really kind of obnoxious when they don't break character, when it's clear that there's a time when they really need to break character because you're trying to find the bathroom or something of that sort. So, but
I feel like if that were to happen to me, I would act the way Sarah Jane did, because I'm super skeptical about everything. So, I'm not going to believe this is time travel. So what could it possibly be? What are the plausible explanations for what's happening?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now we get to finally unpack this. And this is something that we could just dance around the periphery of this all night long. But it really comes down to this conversation. And that is just the fact that Sarah Jane dives into this thing with reactions that are as genuine as we could possibly hope, for the most part. As far as her skepticism, her sort of quizzical nature in dealing with these things, as she processes the information, how she chooses to dive into it, and roll with it in the ways that we would hope, sort of immediately takes it upon her shoulders, and even confronts the doctor, challenges the doctor, condemns the doctor without further information until it's proven otherwise, and is willing to roll back on her decisions.
And Debbie, don't forget her delight and her sense of adventure at this whole thing. She is having a grand time, and it becomes very evident through her performance. It's not only her skepticism, which I adore in this episode, and the fact that she evaluates things based on the facts as she sees them. But she's also willing to change her opinion, change her mind. But she is she's having a blast. And that is so evident in Liz Slate's performance, which I delight in every time I've seen this.
Yeah. I don't know how long they really intended the character to persist, because they had gone through some bumps along the way. It was originally the Sarah Jane character was cast otherwise. It proved during screen tests that there was no chemistry with Pertwee. They had to do a last-minute sort of change and things to bring in Liz Sladen. But, I mean, Debbie, you had said that there were some sticking points, or I should say some things that didn't quite come out in the wash about this. Whether was it the nature of the story, was it the nature of portrayals?
It was very much the nature of the story, and again, I always hesitate to say something isn't good or something isn't well written, because I do think that this is incredibly well written. It is not, I'm about to commit geek heresy right here.
Please
this
do.
This felt very Monty Python-esque at times, and I am not a Monty Python fan.
Okay.
That is not the type of humor that that I find to be rollicking. And there was a lot of that built into the DNA of this, it felt like, sort of very British style of humor. While I can appreciate it and I can look at it objectively, it's not sinking into my bones the way a lot of the story is. What was different for me at this time, and partially it's based on what we're doing with Verity this year in sort of our year of looking at women characters, is viewing this story from a different point of view and looking at the story as Sarah Jane's story and not the Doctor's story. And that kind of flipped it on its head a little bit for me. And I found myself enjoying it a little bit more because of that, and making her the focus. Where I think the first time I watched this, it's just so jarring to see Sarah Jane with the Third Doctor, because in our minds, we so have her embedded as a Fourth Doctor companion.
Sure.
That you almost forget that, there was a little Pertwee action going on there. So looking at it and her delight in this and her skepticism and everything that you had previously mentioned, but also looking at some of the other characters, I love the scene in the kitchen. And it really upsets me that we never saw those people escape the castle. We saw the...
Yes!
Yeah, I kind of wanted to see those women rise up out of the kitchen and, beat the men about the head with a bunch of pots or something.
Or at least not die in the explosion. Like, I would have settled for that. But we don't even get, those characters didn't even get that consideration of seeing them flee as well. We got the bandits out, but, what about those scullery maids? Dang it.
They had such a great opportunity setting it up, because Lord Edward, I think his name was, he had said, if I had, 100 girls like you, I could hold this castle forever, whatever he said. Like, the kitchen's you know, drudges could have been his army, and that would have been fantastic.
Oh yeah, they were fierce. You know, they were just they did what they needed to do, and held no truck with the nonsense of the menfolk upstairs, which I thought was really funny.
I want to believe that to a certain degree, because of the fact that they were so attuned to what was going on. I mean, they could hear some sort of odd bang noise, scuffle, and immediately describe what was going on. That if they heard the slightest inclination that there was that the rats were fleeing the ship, they would have been the first ones out.
I approve of this headcanon.
Done. Call it done. But yeah, that those scenes in particular, the ones where I cannot count on both hands how many exceptional lines Sarah Jane has scattered throughout these four episodes.
All of her lines? I think that's how many?
Almost, yeah.
I would go with all of. I like that. I like that, Haley.
Yeah. It's just gold material. I mean, she hit this thing running so hard that you don't need to know the fact that, you know, something sort of, it sat a little funny in the household here as everyone was sitting back and final credits are rolling and what. And I get asked, but she didn't get asked. So what do you mean she didn't get asked? Well, she didn't get asked if she wants to continue to travel. You know, they ended it with the exit and not sort of that little coda that mm-hmm. normally gets tacked on. They arrive back home. They dust themselves off. Say, well, that was a crazy adventure, wasn't it? You ready for the next one?
Or where to next?
Exactly. And I said, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's just a, you know, the particular nature of they were sort of treating this as a companion pilot to a certain degree. So that if it didn't really pan for viewership, that they could just say, all right, well, learn a lesson, move on, which would be really.
Yep, she was a stowaway. She doesn't get to stay.
Yeah, and also for the modern viewer, you know, you're really missing that moment where she sees the inside of the TARDIS. You know, and we're all looking for that now. Everybody's come to Doctor Who since 2005. You're looking for that. Oh, it's bigger on the inside, or what is this place? And we don't get that.
Wasn't this cooler?
Episode.
I thought this was so much more different, though. Her walking out of it, finding herself in another situation. It's not even reacting to what she found inside, but walking out and going, wait, turning around, looking at the door, kind of swinging the shut. Wait a second.
Also, aren't you a little disappointed in the Brig and the Doctor for not noticing her standing, like, right where they should have seen her out of the corner of her eye in front of the TARDIS?
I don't know. I kind of felt this whole episode. There's the Doctor says a lot of things in this, you know. We need to make the tea. We can do all this. And at the beginning, I remember the first time seeing this and just being like, you know, my hackles raising at this. Because the Doctor isn't like that generally with his female companions.
See, I thought that he said that kind of testing her.
That's
like,
by the end
to see
of
how
yeah.
she would respond.
Definitely by the end of this, I felt that he was really he was putting her to the test to see what she was made of. Mm-hmm. And every time she snapped, she clapped back at him so hard, and it was just glorious. And at the one point where he says, "Oh, that's very generous of you, considering you're the fair sex."
Fair sex.
And she's
like,
"Oh, please."
Exactly. So, Haley, I am absolutely on point with you with that. I think this was absolutely a test of mettle because of the fact the Doctor has learned so much from his time with Joe, and the fact that Joe came so far and was able to open his eyes to so much, and sort of break down a lot of that behavioral cycle. That now he used that as a litmus test. And Sarah Jane took the litmus paper, tore it up, set it on fire, threw it back down, danced on it a little bit, and said, "What do you got next?" And I think there were grins. You could see smirks on his reactions to a lot of her slam back lines. So I think at this point this was really a matter of not only the Doctor, not only the writer. I mean, stepping back behind the camera as well. I think Holmes as writer, and even Letts, well, maybe not so much Terry Dix, but at least Letts had realized that that this is something that there was something absolutely imperative that needed to be delved into further with their titular character.
But I think the moment that this all gels and comes together is when they're, you know, up in the barricade and they've created the dummy knights, and the Doctor has his little pouches that he's going to light on fire, and they're up there and having this conversation. The Doctor is so excited when Iron Gron and his men arrive. Like, he just gets like really giddy, and Sarah Jane smiles. Like, she joins in that giddiness. Do you know what I mean? At that moment, I think he's... they're kind of like they're feeling this relationship. And then I think what really cements it for it's sort of the nice ending to that whole scene is when she asked the doctor, you know, what was that? Some kind of a gas. And he's like, no, you know, it was just harmless. It was, what does he say? It's like sulfur, something that smells and a little bit of fireworks in it in there. Yep. And I thought, okay, she's testing him out too a little bit. Like, is this the type of person that I want to align myself with? Because she already at the beginning we saw that there was no that she honestly believed that he was in on the plot. So I think that, like, that whole scene sort of they were pushing back at each other a little bit, and I think they both were happy with what they found in the other person. He was happy that she was joining in on the adventure, that she had that bravery. She was happy that he turned out to be, he's actually a good guy. He's not actually trying to harm anyone. He just wants to fix the situation and move on. And I think she can really respect that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that sets a great precedent for where they head to from here on. I mean, not sort of getting ahead of ourselves, but it really does cement a lot of their relationship because they realize what ground each of them stands on and the commonality between the two. Now, as far as our adversaries through this, I'm going to throw something at the bunch of you that that could sort of undermine how much I really, really enjoy the story. The doctor could have helped Lynx with no loss of life. He could have just repaired his ship, cleared the castle, let Lynx go back to wherever he needed to go without a human life lost.
But that's where the thing about the ship basically blowing up the castle when it goes to take off is. Like, the doctor recognized that the ship was not reparable, and he was like, no, if you try this, it's going to destroy everybody here. And so there was, I mean, I always assume that it's just he realizes there's no way to stop it. There's no way to get him off the planet safely.
Right. Well, I guess it came down to something where he could have had, because there were a couple of instances where the two of them were having just a straightforward conversation about the nature of what needed to be done. They were both aware of the technology involved. They were both anachronistic to the situation and could have said, all right, we know what's really going on here. Let's let all the savages do all of their shouting and their clanging of armor behind us. But here's, at the end of the day, here's what needs to be done. I will help you get your ship in order. And you can go ahead and take off and do whatever it is you need to do to get back to your fleet. Just allow me to be able to get all of the collateral damage out of the way. And I am more than capable, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, to help you with what you need.
You know, and I thought he would have been slightly more sympathetic to that, considering he has been in a similar position. Being stuck on Earth with no recourse and not being able to leave. That was my first thought was, well, this is going to be an interesting sort of partnership because I can't... The doctor has so frequently shown mercy to other races, even when logic tells him he shouldn't.
Yeah.
So I was really surprised that offer wasn't made because if anyone can understand what the Suntaran was feeling, it would have been the doctor to know what it would be like to be stuck among a primitive species and not have any recourse. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but he seemed right up front to have a real chip on his shoulder about the Suntarans. Like, as soon as Lynx started talking, he's like, oh, yeah, typical Suntaran attitude. Like, yeah. He didn't seem like he really wanted to find a commonality.
Well, there was definitely a lot of disdain for the fact that this was a millennia-old warfare between the Suntarans and the Rutans that obviously we don't know the backstory to, but is something that he, you know, comes straight right short of spitting on the ground before he starts to refer to it. But I don't know. It just seems like there was something missing from the persona of the Doctor as we recognize him at this point that should have been the olive branch at one point, even if it were batted to the ground for, you know, and there could have been some way to be able to write it off as a refusal, but I would have expected it. I still do to a certain degree.
But do you think that's more like our reflection of what we know about the Doctor now, all these years on, and it's maybe not so out of character for the Doctor when the story first aired? I mean, I find myself questioning my thoughts frequently when I go back and look at Classic Who. Like, what expectations am I putting on this story based on the knowledge that I have gained in the ensuing years and how much of it would have been of the era? So I don't know.
Well, this is
that's tricky.
I would throw it at Haley because, Haley, you've been going through this with us chronologically. So we went through the Hartnell, the Troughton, and now the Pertwee eras, and you've been seeing that evolution every other week now. So I mean, as far as avenues that we've explored and facets of the Doctor that we've been able to get a little bit more light shine upon, would this be something that you feel would have been expected, or are we looking too far ahead in the book?
I mean, everything I've seen up to this point, Pertwee's Doctor has always seemed more militant than other iterations of the Doctor we see, and more willing to resort to harsher means if necessary.
Okay. So maybe it's not so much a matter of background as this particular iteration is far more fly-by-night and sort of knee-jerk reaction based on the passion and the intensity of the moment.
In the Velvet.
Passion of the Velvet?
Well, you know, come on.
Wow.
That sounds like a filthy video.
Yeah, we've gone to pulp paperback all of a sudden. This is...
Anybody that wears that much velvet is hiding something deep in their psyche.
I loved the scene where Irongrod comes in and he's like searching through the room and he finds the green velvet jacket on the floor and he picks it up and looks at it like this filthy rag. Ugh. He just can't stand holding the thing. I would have loved to see him react to the feel of the velvet.
Right.
Right.
What if he just like rubbed it against his cheek?
That's what I would have done. I'd probably still do that. All right, well, here's another question for you, because you brought a very good point of things that didn't make any sense. And this is the thing that struck me both times I viewed this. So we have Hal, the adorable little archer boy who went on to become Boba Fett. And when we first meet him, he's trying to kill Irongrod. And Sarah Jane interrupts him, his arrow goes astray, and he's done. Yet when they're going to rescue the Doctor, he shoots his arrow and like knocks the axe out of Irongrod's hand. Like, why didn't he just put that right in the middle of his forehead and end this whole thing? I mean, I know
because it wasn't the last episode yet.
Well, okay, well, let's be real meta about that. I mean, I know at this point, like we're going for a kinder, more gentler solution. We're not trying to kill anybody, but I'm thinking this is what you originally came here for. Here is a perfect opportunity, yet you do the trick shot and knock the axe out of the guy's hand. At that point, I was a little like,
He was trying to impress Sarah Jane.
I would buy that.
Option one.
I would definitely buy that reason.
Option two, Hal the Archer is a slave to mission. On his original outset, he is sent with the sole purpose of killing Irongrod.
Good point. Second
time around, because he's functioning entirely on his own, given his own opportunity to guide his hand, literally, he does not choose to take a life unless he's ordered to do so. So, or maybe he's actually gleaning something from the Doctor in taking the gentler route. I don't know.
I don't know. I think at that point he hadn't really interacted with the Doctor a whole lot. I'm thinking it's more, I would go with more mission. He's more mission focused.
Yeah. Okay.
But still, I would have taken the headshot.
Maybe he knew that, like, you know, that might, you know, be a harder shot to like penetrate the skull or something. I don't know.
Well, he is pretty thick headed. I mean,
that's a nice try. That's a good try.
All right. So I've got a question for you since we're talking about Hal the Archer. So one of the things that Jeremy Bullock has said before was that he understood after the fact that Hal the Archer was being considered to be a second companion. And like he was like, oh, I should have pushed for it and this, that, or the other. But for whatever reason, they decided not to go with that. Could you see Hal being a counterpart for Sarah Jane? Like, you know, being the one that, you know, constantly has to have stuff explained to and...
Yeah, it would have been kind of like having Jamie back.
Jamie and Zoe. It absolutely would have been that dynamic.
Do you think that that would have been a good mix for the for Pertwee and then moving on to Baker? Like, I know that Troughton was able to do it remarkably well, but I'm not sure if this mix would have worked as well.
Yeah, I could see it more with Baker than I could with Pertwee.
Really? I would have thought the opposite. Huh.
Really? Okay. All right. So you lay your case and I'll lay mine and we'll see who makes more of that point.
The only reason why is because I think at this point, because of the fact that this would be happening at a point where Pertwee would be relatively unfamiliar with both characters. So he would be coming into it sort of learning and getting to know you, both of these individuals and from their relative periods at the same time. So he could evolve with them in tandem. It was clear that they were already starting to drop some hints that Hal was kind of sweet on Sarah Jane and so forth, and that's fine. They paint an inch thick. But as far as under the Baker era, I don't think Tom would have allowed that much shared space, personally. It's just a matter of ego. So Tom's my doctor. So, but it still doesn't change the fact that I don't think he would function well having that sort of, because of the fact that they could very easily allude to some sort of a blooming relationship between the two companions that the fourth doctor would have anything to do with it.
See, yeah. I'm kind of thinking that there could have been an interesting play there. Like Haley mentioned, the fact that Pertwee's doctor is a bit more militant or action oriented, that kind of thing. I think he would have gotten along fairly well with Hal, and you know, then Sarah Jane would have been the one on the outs. And then when we switched over to Baker, I think it would have reversed. That, you know, all of a sudden Baker's like, no, we're not going to shoot our way out of this. We can talk about it. And suddenly Sarah Jane becomes the favorite.
Well, I never really got the impression that Hal was a particularly militant individual. I think he was cunning.
No, but he's definitely more action-oriented, which is what the third doctor would have been drawn to. Yeah.
Sure. I would have been interested to see Hal interacting with the Brig. Yes. And, like, the unit boys.
Now, see, my take is that Pertwee's the type of... He doesn't suffer fools gladly. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't... He's not a patient doctor, where some of the other doctors are slightly more... Maybe not. No, they're none of them are patient. What am I even saying? That's a lie. It's a lie. But Pertwee's has always been a little harsher, a little more cutting of tongue, more sophisticated, I would say. And that was the whole vibe they were going for. Whereas the fourth doctor was just, he always had that sort of goofy persona. He seemed like he would delight in the anachronisms of having a companion who was discovering modern life. I think, not that he would delight in it, I think he would probably make more jokes about it. I think he'd be more tolerant of it. And that's the only thing I'm thinking, not even personality and budding romance and that sort of thing. But I just think the idea of having, what do you do with a character, and the problem they had with Katarina back in Dalek's Master Plan, like, what do you do with a character that doesn't understand any of this? And now, obviously, we had Jamie, who was, you know, from a slightly more advanced society, it is. But... I don't see Pertwee's doctor having the patience for that and having to constantly explain basic things as they travel. Where I think the fourth doctor would probably be more cruelly making fun of him, but at least
that's true. Yeah, it would delve into some really biting sarcasm that would go right over Hal's head. I think that would sort of become a shtick for a while. But I think, to a certain degree, I mean, this goes back to some basic kind of granted, this is kind of top of mind right now, but some improv concepts. If you've got a companion or a potential companion, say you're teeing somebody up or sort of piloting somebody to see if they've got the metal to do it, and they're just not getting it. It's going beyond just questioning everything and just railing against everything because it doesn't make sense. That's got to be exhausting for your characters, and even more so for the audience, because you've got no give. So I would imagine that if you've got a doctor iteration that is more willing to play around with the pieces you've been given, all right, I see these Legos don't exactly match up, but if I can get a little more creative with the way that I manipulate them and I put them into situations where I can involve some other pieces that sort of fit things together, I can get something kind of interesting out of it, rather than just saying in a very joking way, ha, 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 look at this horrible mess I've made with these people and their lives, because they obviously don't get it, and it's just nothing ever fits, and isn't this funny? So I don't know. I don't really know which one would be a more, I don't know which would be a more successful pairing or grouping, but I think I know personally which would be a more entertaining grouping, I guess, at the end of it all. But,
oh well.
Well, we always like to wrap up these classic rewatches by talking about the rewatchability and the recommendability of this for people that are uninitiated. Rewatchability for us, recommendability for people that are starting to put together their primer sets or their must-haves when it comes to the individual Doctor's eras. So, Haley, as far as rewatchability, I mean, you pretty much expressed it. You were ready to go right back around episode one, start over again, right?
Yeah, so definitely rewatchable.
Okay.
Recommendable, I mean, it's Sarah Jane's first episode, and after this episode, I am completely 100% on board. I understand why she's everybody's favorite. You have to watch it for her introduction. You know, I mean, as far as a Pertwee episode goes, it's not really anything special for him, but, you know, for Sarah Jane, it's critical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that ties right into, Deb, what you were saying, where this is really something where you could basically watch this and change the title credits from being Doctor Who and saying, Sarah Jane.
Yep, absolutely.
And this is her story. The Doctor is just there to move crap forward.
Mm-hmm.
But this is her story. So all that being said, rewatchability, you said this was your second go around on this.
Yeah, it was my second go around, but that's just because, you know, it is, as we like to say, a not for me sort of episode when it comes to the story. Okay. As far as a Sarah Jane episode, I definitely would recommend this to people to watch. I would not recommend this as a first Sarah Jane story, only because it is incredibly, Sarah Jane with the Third Doctor and Sarah Jane with the Fourth Doctor are such completely different beasts that I kind of would want a new Sarah Jane viewer to watch her with the Fourth Doctor and then go back and watch her origin story as sort of background. But it's definitely, it sets up her character so beautifully that it's a delight to go back and discover this later, which is what I did. I had watched other Sarah Jane stories, and then I went back and watched this. I don't think I've ever watched Doctor Who in order. I'm more like, hey, recommend me a clutch of episodes, and I'll go see them.
Hmm. I can feel Haley twitching from here.
Haley, I feel your pain because I am such a linear thinker, but it just... that was sort of the way it started. And now once we started recording Verity, because I didn't start until watching Doctor Who until 2005, like I am sort of the entry port, as you are, to new viewers who are coming in. So now I have to kind of put the brakes on and watch things for the podcast. And it's killing me sometimes. I would definitely, I'm not throwing this one out. It just has a level of humor that is not my style. So that kind of detracts from my enjoyment a little bit, but there's other people that love it and I completely understand why.
All right. So you would probably include it in your Pertwee box set?
No.
No. Okay.
I wouldn't, only because...
Oh, no, that's fair.
I wouldn't include it in my Pertwee box set because Sarah Jane is not his companion. And it's such an outlier for me to watch those two together, where I think I would watch any Joe Grant episode. It's hard. It's really hard for me to wrap my brain around Sarah Jane and the Third Doctor. it's fundamentally wrong on so many levels.
These two dishes should not touch each other on the plate.
Pretty much. Peas and mashed potatoes should not. They like need to be in separate corners. They're both delicious, but...
Nah, together. Well, we'll have to have the extended conversation at some point about what would be your definitive Sarah Jane Tom Baker story. All right, we'll save that for another one.
Yeah, you can bring me back for that one. We can talk about that.
We'll do. Jay, as far as rewatchability and recommendability, where would you stand on this?
Yeah, this is one of my... personal favorite classic stories. It's just a lot of fun. There is some goofy humor. There's some things that may not add up, but on the whole, it's a good story. It makes sense. The characters are enjoyable. There's not a lot that I can detract from this. It's just one of those that's really solidly put together. And as far as recommendability, this was one of the first classic stories that I ever watched, and I got excited about watching the classics again. I remembered that I had watched it when I was a kid, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember this show, and I want to watch it. And it wasn't until I got some others that I was like, oh, this is why people don't watch them. But I would absolutely recommend this to anybody that's even considering getting back into the classics, because this is a good example of what the classics have to offer.
Excellent. I know at least a half a dozen reasons why this would be near and dear to you. So that's that's without saying. I know rewatchability goes as written. Recommendability, I would say that this is something where I would want you either to be as Haley said, I want you to be familiar with the Third Doctor. This would not be an introduction to the Third, because we've always actually discussed that as well. Would this be the first Pertwee
episode?
No.
By
so
no,
no
means.
There are the Autons. That would be my first recommendation.
All right. But I think I would include it on both lists. I would probably put it in the box set there, but it would be one where I'd say that this may be the last. Well, I don't know. We got a little ways to go. So, season 11 still got some great gifts to hand to you before we're done here. But this might be the last one chronologically that I would include in the box set. We'll discuss this as we get through some of the last stories we have here. One last kind of point on this. I will say, I mean, we were talking about the Jay, you mentioned the supporting characters. I will say that as far as like Irongron and Bloodaxe and some of our supporting characters and Rubish and so forth, really, really enjoyed a lot of them. We often don't get a chance to really delve into some of our supporting characters. I think the only guys that really drove me crazy through this story that I just really could have done without were the two idiots at the portcullis, but so be it. They're going to get knocked out by the dumbest magic trick ever. You know, the what's in this hand? I turn my two hands over, I punch you both in the neck. Come on. I'm crying out loud.
That was pretty bad.
It was almost Three Stoogey.
Yeah. But you saw it coming. I mean, it was one take. The camera never cut. It was just, you sat there, and it was like 30 feet back. The camera's like up on a box somewhere in the distance, and you're watching this thing going, really? Really, we're gonna go through this whole bit?
Really?
Oh, we're doing okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, I'd love there at some point to be like sort of a compendium of all of the sort of goofy, ditzy, mad scientist types that the Doctor seems to collect as he goes along in these stories. Because Rubish was a fantastic character. There's so many characters like him sprinkled throughout Doctor Who. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have wanted to see a lot more with Rubish because of the fact that his eyes are, well, that's a horrible pun. His eyes are open to so much, but they're really not open to anything.
I expected better of you.
Oh, then you haven't been listening.
But he is one of the few really engaging characters that they have not explored any further in comics, in any of the extended stories. Fan fiction, nothing. Rubish never gets explored further. I am personally taking it on as a debt I owe to Donald Pelmere as an actor to say, sir, you did a fine job holding your homemade lens up to your eye.
Yeah. Hashtag respect the Rubish. Twitter
right,
trend tomorrow.
Deb, we've got something we're going to have to subject you to, as if this conversation weren't enough.
After my technical difficulties, you can subject me to whatever you like. I owe this to you guys.
Fair
enough. All right, get out the secret list here.
Oh, my God.
Secret list. We will absolutely subject you to 5 rounds rapid, which will be our really quick, just off the cuff, this is a simple kind of, it's not even a trivia conversation, it's just your personal reaction to some questions that have to do with your relationship with Doctor Who as a franchise.
Okay, I'm ready.
So, yeah, well, your entry point, where did you come into Doctor Who?
Rose.
Okay.
2005, it was right after the season ended, it was recommended to me by a bunch of friends on LiveJournal. Remember LiveJournal? LiveJournal was awesome.
Wow.
Who I was fanish friends with in another fandom, and everybody kept talking about this crazy show and have to watch. I learned everything I know about illegally downloading things from Doctor Who.
Harumph, 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 harumph.
Yeah. Thank Haley, goodness we don't one. Have to live in those dark days
anymore.
Yeah,
this anymore. Is before we knew better. It's fine.
That's right. Now we do. I feel very guilty about it, and I spent lots of money in the interim buying things. So
there you go. So you've made up your... Yeah. Absolutely. Haley, take the next one.
All right. Next question. Forget your doctor. Who is your companion?
Oh, this is really hard because it depends on the day of the week. But I always go back to my first one. I always go back to Rose. She was incredibly flawed. She was incredibly brave. She was my entry point into Doctor Who fandom. I loved her, warts and all, and I still do. It's always hard to walk away from your first.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. So, all right, we've got different kinds of episodes with Doctor Who. You've got the bottle episodes, the one and done, the whole series arcs, or like the long game arc that we see sometimes. Which would you personally choose as your favorite?
You know, I got so tired of the long arc with the whole Clara the Mystery Girl thing. But that being said, if I could sort of create a mashup, I really like what they did with Russell Davies did in series one. You had sort of a Monster of the Week episode, and there was a very subtle arc that you didn't realize until the end. Mm-hmm. I would like to have that again. I like the season-long arc. I just don't want to be smacked in the face with it every single episode. I'd like it to be a little more subtle.
It's like the fringe approach to Doctor Who.
Yes. Yes.
So, okay, as we are standing on the precipice, well, we're not really on the precipice, we're climbing up the hill to get ourselves to the precipice of what will be the outset of Series 11 in autumn of 2018, whatever the heck BBC decides autumn really means.
Anything up till December 21st, I guess. Right.
So what is your greatest expectation for the series to come?
Oh, my gosh. You know something? I want this Doctor to be exactly the same as any other doctor that we have ever had. I have hope. It may be fragile, but I have hope that we're not going to get all sorts of, you know, funny little gendered comments about this doctor. I just want her to walk in. I want her to have some bitchin' pockets, and I want her to just walk into a room like she's the doctor that she is and not have to explain anything to anybody about anything at all.
That's absolutely fair. I think we've all been kind of alluding to the same thing, too, where it's something where we just want to show that it's the same combination of wonder and whimsy, and it really doesn't – well, it matters whose mouth it comes out of. We want this quality talent here. You know, she wasn't cast because she just happens to know Chris really well, and they, you know, grew up in the same town and that sort of thing. But yeah, this is something where you want the – all of the magic of what the show is to persist, and that seamlessness to be something that says, you know, what were you so afraid of?
Exactly.
All along.
Exactly. We were talking about this in our episode coming out. I don't know when this is going to drop, but we talked about the enemy of the world and talking about the character of Astrid. That could be a gender blind casting. That character could be played by a man, played by a woman with no changes whatsoever. Mm. And I love that. And I'd love to see that for Jodie Whittaker's Doctor.
Yeah. All right. Haley, bring us home for the fifth question. Yep.
Last question. So the doctor asks you, all of time and space, where do you want to go?
Oh, how political am I allowed to get on this show?
Go ahead. We're not going to flinch. Do it.
I want to go 5 years in the future to see that we have survived this hot-ass mess that we're in right now.
Oh, it's 3 years now. We're getting closer.
Okay, but you know, something's going to take a little bit of recovery time.
Okay.
I want to go 5 years in the future. I want to know that we made it through. I want to know that we've tilted democracy back in the right direction. My hopes and my aspirations are really small these days. I just want to go 5 years ahead because I want to see where we land.
Yeah, long games don't exist anymore. Now, your mid-game is where your strength is.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we got some interesting news this week. Jay, are we ready to delve into this?
Absolutely.
All right. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's go back and revisit the Christmas special. Apparently, Jenna Coleman's appearance was going to be a little bit longer and very different.
Yeah. Has everybody sort of looked over this particular synopsis? Because this is kind of
I have not. I have chin hands right now. Fill me in.
Okay. So if we are to take everything as reported here, this cameo that we were given, as far as Clara's sort of walk on conversation was intended to be on first pass very different. This was something I think actually in the interview that Stephen Moffat had with Crystal D for the Doctor Who fan show, he had sort of alluded to this to a certain degree, but as a result of the editing, they had so much material to put together with Moffat, Bradley, and Gatiss and things that a lot of this probably got left on the cutting room floor. But Rachel Talley had actually said, as far as the importance of making sure that she appeared, time constraints didn't really allow for the conversation to actually be for the Doctor to flat out say to Clara, "You were always my favorite." But the funny thing being, the fact that both Bill and Nardal were in the room, as it were. So Clara would try to clarify who was. And Bill asked, which one? And Nardal would be the one to say, I know. Just to screw with the viewers' minds over and over again. And even as they describe here, Capaldi's Time Lord was then supposed to give a wicked laugh, and we've seen what happens when Capaldi laughs on camera. It's terrifying. And then whiz off in the TARDIS, leaving all of the companions none the wiser. That would have been a horrible, horrible exit.
But it would have been so terrible. Very Moffat.
It would have been so cruel to the fans. Yeah. I'm glad it didn't happen.
Yeah, precisely.
See, I remember when we discussed the episode, I very much liked that, you know, we got a little final farewell between him and Jenna, but that wasn't the focus of the end of the episode.
Yeah,
they've had their goodbye. They've had their moment. This was Bill's turn, and I really wanted her to have that.
Yeah.
And Nardal, too, I feel like it was handled much better this time than it was with Matt Smith bringing back Amy.
Yeah. Well, this had, and as we discussed this when we were talking about this episode, this had, there was a reason for it.
Yeah.
I mean, this was, as expressed, this was a gift back to the Doctor of something that should have been his, that was taken from him. To restore his memories, because it was the only thing that this collective memory data bank could possibly provide. It's the only thing it can do. It's a manifestation. It's a collection of memory. The nether sphere, if you will. but could give this back to him. And so that in and of itself was something where you could say, all right, that's valid. And it's something that could be owed to the Doctor. But no, the Amy's walk-on, I'm still having issues with. all right. Next piece of dump two. We've got a little bit of a discrepancy over running time.
Our patience may be rewarded.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I don't know, because there's still 90 minutes floating out in the ether. Here's the deal. So as we've been having these conversations with the official releases and the official word from Chris Chibnall and from BBC Wales and so on, that of what our expectations are going to be for Series 11, you know, obviously we're going to return in autumn 2018, whatever that is, with a one-hour premiere, and then we will have a set of, what is it, nine mm-hmm. episodes?
Nine.
Yes, that, nine more.
Episodes that run roughly 50 minutes, which brings us, by calculation, to a certain amount of running time.
510 minutes.
Here's the problem. As it seems to be so often the case now, toy companies keep screwing things up. This has plagued Disney and all of their various entrapments with the things that they write on the back of their toy boxes and stuff. This has plagued them for a while, and now it's starting to affect BBC as well. Although I think I've noticed it a couple times with BBC on some of the things they put on some of their sonic screwdriver back of the boxes and such. But apparently there was some sort of a write-up that said something about the total amount of content that we were expecting, some advertisement that ran Toy World magazine, who are usually the ones who get the official releases of what's going to be released by the BBC as far as officially sanctioned merchandise, said more than 11 hours, than 11 hours of new content in autumn of 2018. Well, it doesn't add up.
I wonder if there's like maybe some sort of half hour post show that they're planning and they're including that kind of time.
Okay. So please tell me that Chris Hardwick is not going to step forward with yet another after hours show.
He found 47 minutes in his schedule every week where he wasn't like eating, sleeping, or doing another show. So,
talking
yeah,
to
he's free.
I'm done with Chris Hardwick. I'm very much done.
Thank you. I thought I was the only one who was done with Chris
Hardwick. Oh, my God. I can't stand it.
We'll be the team of two. Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah. But, yeah, so everything adds up. So even if they're counting in the Christmas special, that still means that we're roughly about 90 minutes short of what they're describing.
You know, I wish I could say that I had faith that the BBC, like, had all this stuff scheduled out as far and as accurately as that as we think they should, but you know, I've read the writer's tale, or the writer's room, or whatever Davies thing was that he published. They're not that organized. They're not that as together as we think. So there seems to be television just works differently over there. It really does.
Well,
and I always get very frustrated when it's like, if we had a show that was premiering, a big show that was premiering in the United States, like we'd be hearing about a year in advance. They're like, well, it's going to be sometime in autumn. 2 weeks before it airs, we may give you a date. Maybe. Possibly. So I don't
know. Game of Thrones. You know, imagine if they didn't tell us when Game of Thrones was going to premiere next year.
Yeah. Mm. And like 3 weeks ahead of time, you'll be like, yes, next week we'll let you know. And it's, you know, how can you schedule your life like that? I don't even know. This is appointment television. I'm sorry. Like, I need to know these dates.
Don't worry. They're going to do an announcement with like a 15-second video during a tennis tournament to let us know when the new episodes will premiere.
That's true. That's so true. Ouch. No, football should be back on by then. So.
Well, speaking of news that came about as a result of something that emerged from one of these tennis matches, whatever that sport is, we do have some thoughts regarding Jodie Whittaker's first episode in full. And a lot of that has to do with the nature of what we saw at the close of Twice in a Lifetime. Or Twice Upon a Time. Sorry, I keep changing the title of that in my head because I really wanted it to be called Twice in a Lifetime, like some sort of bad James Bond movie. And this has to do with the fact that the TARDIS literally blew itself to pieces internally as a result of the sheer force of this delayed regeneration. And that note, listeners, that that's the way that we're describing it, because for all the people that didn't really understand why it was that the Doctor got ejected out into the open air, had to do with the fact that, as we have seen historically, the longer you stay off a regeneration, the more impactful it is. And if you happen to be in a moving vehicle at the time, you're probably going to have some issues. So
you would think he would learn by now to just put the thing in park until it was over.
Just stand in the middle of an open field.
Find a safe space. It's all good. Like, it's not your first rodeo, Doctor. You've done this before.
Or maybe do it, like, in the swimming pool instead of the control console room.
Yeah, right. Might be.
Of your ship, of which there's only one left.
Precisely. The Zed room, which apparently is just there for nothing. It's null space. So head there. But nonetheless, the fact that we have dealt with some severe TARDIS damage as a result of this leads a lot of people to believe that the theory stands that we are going to have an Earthbound first episode, which could have a lot of advantages, I think, if we are setting this in present day, you know, or relative viewer present day. Because that then means that we've got, with everything that's changing, you know, lack of companion, new doctor, new production crew, new tonality, and everything that's going to come along with it, the only touchstone that we have as viewers is the fact that she lands in present-day London, or, you know, Cardiff, impersonating as London, or what have you. Or where else is she going to land, really? But at least having her for the entirety of that first 60-minute episode, entirely Earthbound, allows us to be able to see how this this stranger in a strange land behaves, and then we can start to venture forward from there. So I posit to the rest of you, would you rather see our first go-round with our 13th Doctor winging it off into some other location within time and space, or just see how she deals with what's right around the corner from us for a little while and then gets weird?
You know, with the exception of Capaldi, every modern Doctor has had a modern day story to start off with.
Mm? Yeah, then they jump to the past and they jump to the future, and then we start to kind of settle into a routine. I'd heard the rumor that this was going to be an entirely an Earthbound series, like Pertwee's first season, actually, where they're kind of stuck and let's try to get this TARDIS thing going back so we can actually travel and let's pick up some companions along the way. I think that would be kind of interesting, actually, because the focus then would be on the character development, as not so much the what crazy off-world adventure can we and prosthesis can we use to sort of distract you from what's happening here.
Well, and if they do that, we get to have Kate Stewart and Osgood there all the time.
Well, I'm down for that. Nine times
all
out of ten.
All the time.
All the time. Yep. Yeah. I think let's go back to that Liz Shaw first season where, you have UNIT and oh, that would just make me so happy. I know it's not going to happen, but give me a moment here. I think it would just be really nice. It would be so different because we're talking about breaking a pretty set tradition in Doctor Who of how the seasons tend to roll out. So I think if Chibnall wants to come in and completely blow the doors off and put his stamp on it, I think that'd be a really cool way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it would take a lot of people by surprise as far as their expectations, because they'd be tuning into it to see how Jodie Whittaker does with all the rubber monsters on the, on the various locations shot in a quarry that happened to be some sort of alien landscape. But no, she's in Swindon.
Yeah, but then you'll get like Ian Levine saying, see, she couldn't even drive the TARDIS. She can't fix the car. She can't get off the planet. What good is she? She's useless. You know, there's fanboys out there, bitter, bitter fanboys out there waiting to to type something about parking the TARDIS.
I'm just expecting my next box of salt that I purchased from the Morton's company to have Ian's little visage stamped across the side of it.
Gosh, we're mean. We're mean tonight.
No, we're very positive. I'm absolutely positive that Ian Levine is a horrible little person. But all right, last little piece
here.
We're going to put this in here because this is something that made us not only stupid happy, but it made us absolutely have to change our vacation plans, travel plans.
Are you really going to go here, Kier? Are you going to go where I think you're going? Are you thinking like Baltimore?
I'm personally not a big fan of downtown Baltimore myself. I have a lot of issues with their traffic patterns, the cost of a meal.
Pattern is a strong word.
Pattern. a lack of movement. The cost of an average meal and parking. But I will be damned. Damned, I say. If Oney Hartstein and James Hartnell keep me away from the hotel once again for the fourth iteration of Regeneration Who, for no other reason than the fact that they found some guy.
Some weird Scott.
Poofy-haired weirdo fancies himself a fan of the people. Who they've added onto the roster at the absolute 11th hour here. Or should I say 12th hour?
12th hour?
12th hour. That'd be more appropriate. Thank you. I thank you. Try the veal. Regeneration Who has taken an already absolutely astounding roster and has added Peter Capaldi at the last possible minute for reasons that I think bear mention. Peter has not done a lot of con work since the show has wrapped. And has outside
of Wizard Worlds, he's done none. Correct. Or so, sanctioned BBC events as well in the UK.
Correct. So his first voyage back to the States to meet the public after the whole NYCC kerfuffle, or what were they calling it? The BBC takeover that weekend?
Right? BBC takeover.
Has decided to come back specifically for this convention because of the fact that it has such an intrinsic connection to the fans and to the local community, and it absolutely does. I've had the opportunity to come to Regen on for a couple of years running now. Thought I was going to miss it this year, but I'm scrambling to come back in. With great thanks to Kara Dennison, Craig Matthews, and Oni and James, and all the rest of the staff that make this happen, because of the fact that they make Herculean efforts of this nature. They could have sat back and rested on their laurels and said, look at this lineup. You know, come see our multiple doctors. Come meet Michelle Gomez. Come spend time with Rachel Talalay. Come hang out with John Leeson. Come hang out on a single floor of a hotel convention center where you are going to share elevator time on numerous occasions with individuals that you have only seen in two dimensions for your entire life. And not only be able to attend great panels with them and fantastic Q&As with moderators that really go beyond just the usual, you know, major Comic-Con kind of foray, and get into some of the more interesting subject matter, sort of beneath the surface. And if Michelle Gomez is there, you know it's going to get weird. It's absolutely going to get weird. I mean, as we can speak from bananas. Galley experience. But now you have the opportunity to have this phenomenal creative team together that you're going to be spending the weekend with. That still has a very small con proximity and feel and camaraderie. It's indescribable. It really is. And has not, as it has grown in attendance size, it has not lost any of its warmth. So all the love in the world to this group and everything they put together. So if you're planning on coming out, we will see you there. We absolutely will see you there. Haley's scrambling as we speak to try and make arrangements to come back out to the East Coast for that. Your hotel room is waiting.
Yep.
You know, I want to give this convention props too. I have not had a chance to attend Regen as of yet because just the time of the year that is always extremely difficult for me. But they have an incredible policy when it comes to the convention as far as inclusivity and diversity and their sexual harassment policy. They really take this stuff seriously and they're very transparent in all of this. And especially in a culture where this has been a little bit of a problem from the start, they have made this part of their core ethics. And I respect that so very much because it is, it's easy to let that kind of stuff slide, especially when you're putting on a convention. And this is not a convention when you think of a New York Comic Con or when you think of a Wizard World. This is a fan convention run by fans. They're very professional, but it has a whole entirely different feel to it. It has a different level of accessibility and has a different level of, as you say, Kier, panels. You're not just scraping the top. You're not going for the lowest denominator questions. You're really deep diving into things that, as a fan, you want to hear more of. And I think that to have Peter come to that type of a convention as his first convention post-Doctor Who, it says a lot about him as both an actor and a fan of the show, but also what this convention is trying to do. So I give them huge props. I will not be there, sadly, even though it's an hour and a half from my home. I will instead be at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex and Expo Center that weekend.
What the heck is that?
Are you going to have your own panels there?
It is the Keystone Region bid for national championships for USA Volleyball. And my daughter plays competitive volleyball It is their national bid tournament weekend, and the sound that you are not hearing is me slamming my head against the desk because it's an hour and a half from my house. I have stayed at the hotel many times where this convention is held. It hurts. Guys, it hurts. Parenthood is not for the weak.
Will any of the Verities be there? Like, any?
No, none of us. I'm the only one on the East Coast. I'm the only one that's close.
But this is something that I figured people moving time and space to make it happen.
Well, you figure, like, we have two people who live in Edmonton, which is about as far away from here as you can get unless you're Tansy in Tasmania, Australia. You know, Liz is in the UK. Lynn is probably the most accessible. She's in Urbana, Illinois at the moment, but her schedule is crazy already with travel for her real life job. So, I am the only one that had a shot at this, and Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex and Expo Center.
That sounds awesome. If you don't even describe why you're really there, just say, I'm at the Pennsylvania Farm Show, right there, all of a sudden.
I'm going to win that weekend. You guys just think you are.
I'm picturing you herding goats.
Shearing sheep.
The pain is real. I literally, in one of our Slack channels, was inarticulate screaming when the announcement dropped, because at that moment I was offering up my hotel room to Regen. Because I had realized the dates were going to conflict. And as I am typing, hey, I have a hotel room, somebody was literally posting the news about Peter Capaldi. There were words that came out of my mouth I'm not proud of.
Nope. Well, we will do our best. We're working on our panel approvals for that weekend. We know for certain there's no way that we will not do our famous / infamous Who Didn't game show, which was actually premiered at Regen a year or so back, with the beautiful and voluptuous Robert Shearman joining us on the panel. And if he's foolish enough, he may join us again along with a few of our other Whovian writers. And we're working on some other things with regards to things like some of our previous conversations on the Doctor Companion symbiosis. And a couple of other interesting topics. So lots of stuff on the roster for that weekend. Please do head over to regenerationwho.com. You can still get, I don't know if you can get full weekend badges at this point because things went.
Yes.
Kind of went crazy for some reason or other.
You can still? Haley, you checked?
Yeah. I was just looking at it not too long ago. They were listed.
As of the date we were recording, you can still get a full day. And there were still a handful of hotel rooms. There are some adjacent hotels around that area. But I would highly recommend trying to get into the hotel proper or really become very close friends with someone who's already staying. Because the proximity is key. The nature of this convention is its closeness. That's what really makes it the warm fuzzy that it really is. Not to mention the fact that you can send somebody downstairs for morning coffee, and that's always a great thing. You will be the king of your room if you walk back up with the tray.
We have the baby trained by then?
Sort of. He's walking. He just started walking last week.
We'll just put a tray on his head. It'll be perfect.
I'm not saying he's stable. I'm just saying he's walking. He's a little
sippy
shaky.
Cups all around.
Sippy cup coffees. Well, every coffee should really be a sippy cup when you think
about it. Also, he'll need a stick to hit the buttons on the elevator, probably.
Probably so.
Might need
unless
to teach
we
him
just
numbers.
We could just pin a note to him that says, if you see me in the elevator, press 5. That's okay.
Yeah.
This is descending rapidly. When we convene for next week, we're going to have a conversation off of our classic rewatch where we get to explore some other topics. We're going to just let everyone stop talking and listen to the music for a little while because we want to delve into, as we know that this has been our last opportunity around the story with Murray Gold putting his compositions in our ear. We're going to do a little bit of a retrospective to look back at the music of the Doctor that takes us everywhere, all the way back to Derbyshire's first interpretation of the original theme song. So really has to do with the, as I like to describe it, the score as the unseen character in the scene. So it should be an interesting conversation for those of you who happen to hear the scene before you see it, if that makes any sense to you.
All right. Well, this has been episode 269 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, you know, I'm really smart. I can figure out a way to get out of this. What am I going to eat? Hey, look, great spider.
And this is Kier saying, rubbish. Joseph, rubbish.
And this is Haley saying, because I never lie. Well, hardly ever.
We'll see you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Where we've just returned from the absolute weirdest evil at medieval times you could possibly imagine.
Wait,
seriously,
wait.
Couldn't even
the weirdest evil evening. At medieval times? Evening.
Did
try
I
try that? All right. The weirdest evil at mid-evening times.
Sorry, I wouldn't have messed that up had I not finished off like a full beer before we started recording.
That's, yeah, well.
It's not my fault. It's not my fault.
Oh, hi, Mark.